Movie theaters are modern-day pulpits. Real-world theology exists to shed a light on the narratives that are shaping our culture and to remind viewers that entertainment is not mindless.
Welcome to Real World Theology, episode 110. We're joined by Joshua Crabb, editor at Real World Theology, and also Griffin Kale, one of our contributors here at the site. So listen up, because we've got a really great show for you. On this episode, we're talking Kubo and the Two Strings and redemptive storytelling.
So do you realize, I think, Griffin, I don't think that we've been on with Mikey since the first time I was on ever.
Yeah, your very first show, which we reviewed another kid. Okay, Fight. Oh, really?
Yeah.
Wow.
You did Fight Club?
Yeah.
Honestly, I can't remember who did anything. I feel like every time I have a guest on now, they're like, oh, remember when I was like, lots of times I try to get guests on. I'm like, oh, these guys haven't been together at all. But obviously I'm not doing my due diligence, which is on, you know, on me. That's my fault.
Nice.
But I'm like, oh, yeah, Griffin and Josh, they'll work well together. And then, yep, who double-checed? Not this guy.
It was a long time ago, though.
So,
it was way back when.
Actually, that's like last year, right? Didn't we do Fight Club last year?
Yeah.
2 years ago? It was last year. It was about this time last year.
No. It was 2 years ago.
Was it two years ago?
Yeah.
This podcast has been going on forever.
Forever, ever?
Oh man, yeah. So that's that's cool. Well, I'm gosh, we have been, but I'm glad that both of you are back on the podcast, even though it's been 2 years since you were together, reunited, as some might say.
And it feels so good.
That's right. Obviously, the feeling is mutual because it's going around. United. But I like having both. You, Griffin, and you, Josh, on these type of episodes for very kind of different reasons. I know Griffin is really, really into good animation. And I know, Josh, you have children. So whether you are into animation or not, you get to watch animated movies all the time. Mm-hmm. Thus, even if you were not, if you didn't have excellent sensibilities about these things, by volume, you have the same kind of sensibilities.
Yes. So like by the time something like this comes around, I'm so appreciative of it, my reviews can tend to get very effusive. So
yeah, I'm always curious about you, and there's another guy, the guy trying to think, help me out. We recorded with him on Good Dinosaur there, Mikey.
Oh, who did we do Good Dinosaur with? I thought we did a Good Dinosaur with Alexis.
No. Oh, was it Alexis? There was somebody else too. But yes, I'm always curious talking to you guys who just have to watch so much of this stuff because your kids or whatever. And I'm just like, oh, I wonder, yeah, when you get to these big ones that are just hitters, like the hardest hitters in the world, whenever it comes to like quality wise, just if you rip the script out of it for whatever reason and just watch the film silent or whatever, it's just like, wow, this is just incredibly different from everything else that's coming out and has come out in the last, you know, few years visually. If you're like, yeah, it's just a strange looking film, and I like it a lot.
Well, that's the thing about Kubo and the Two Strings. It looks so different than almost every other animated movie that we're likely to, or we have gotten and we're likely to get this year in 2016, that I wonder if it either scares people off or confuses people, because this movie is done or is created, given to us, whatever, handed down from above by Laika Studios. And they have given us Coraline, Paranorman, the Box Trolls, et cetera, et cetera. Like that, this very distinct style of animation. Mm. And like I said, it sticks out because it's not just CGI animation. It's not, you know, it's not hand-drawn animation. It's not claymation. You know, it's this very, very lovingly crafted animation. And the thing is, and why I wonder if it scared people off is because I feel like these movies never do well. but everyone who does see them doesn't stop talking about them. Like, mm-hmm. I still haven't seen the Box Trolls because I look at it and I'm like, there's something odd about it. It's something off. And I just can't bring myself to watch it. But everyone I know who's seen the Box Trolls is like, the Box Trolls is one of, like, you know, some people told me it was the best animated movie the year it came out. Mm-hmm. And, but I remember really liking Coraline and thinking it was very imaginative and different. But
can I just interject quickly?
Yeah,
Mikey?
Yeah.
You need to see the Box Trolls.
See, that's the thing. Like, that's what I've heard. And it's been sitting in my Netflix queue for so long. I do the Netflix thing, the thing that we probably do. Sure. I'm like scrolling through my list and I'm like, not tonight. You know, I'm scrolling, not tonight. And then, you know, you waste 30 minutes doing that and you're like, I guess I'll just go to bed. Yeah. Like, that's me scrolling through the Box Trolls every time, even though everyone who has told me to watch it, and again, seen Coraline, like the movies in general that the studio puts out, just something about it stops me, and that's on me. But I kind of share that, saying I wonder if I'm not the only one, because again, the Box Trolls bombed, despite how many people loved it. The other movies didn't really make a ton of money, even though, you know, they were very highly rated. Kubo and the Two Strings seems to be in a very similar place. It mm-hmm. came out, it was arguably the best animated movie we've either gotten this year, according to many, or at least any time recently. So mm-hmm. when people see an animated film, it seems like they always just assume it's a kid's movie. But as we're kind of talking, this Laika Studios, they seem to have this dark thread that runs through their narratives, and you can tell it in the trailer. It's not just like a wacky animal does the fun thing, or the kid has the fun time, or they slap Disney on it, whatever they do. So when we have movies like this, I think, and we've talked about this before on other episodes, we have to kind of ask ourselves, are these films from the studio really appropriate for kids? And so that's why I kind of wanted to ask you that first, Josh, before we even talk about how much we either enjoyed it or it connected with us. I'm just kind of curious, you know, as a parent of like 40 or 50 kids, however many you have,
I'm being grossly misrepresented here. All right.
because I know you've moved to Utah and you've yes. had whatever,
a bunker.
So like, is there, and I guess I'm not really necessarily asking just about Kubo. I'm asking about like Laika Studios, like are there films a little more mature, or is it just like a darkness that audiences kind of shy away from or assume their kids won't handle, and they just don't even bother engaging, even though they maybe should?
Yeah, you know, and I'm not the first one to sort of bring up this parallel or make this connection, but I think about someone like Jim Henson. Mm-hmm. You know, you think back to like to the 80s, you think of The Dark Crystal, mm-hmm. which I believe the Next Picture Show did kind of like a comparison episode between this Kubo and the Two Strings and The Dark Crystal. You know, and you think of like Labyrinth, you know, something that, I mean, Labyrinth is certainly geared to a little bit older audience than children. You know, David Bowie is scary in his own right. But, you know, I think of like this, The Dark Crystal, maybe some of the things that Jim Henson had said about just, you know, that it's kind of healthy for children to maybe be a little bit scared or afraid to address some darker material. And, you know, to a certain extent, I kind of agree with that. And I think that Laika has always tended more towards like these a little bit darker aesthetic, both just, you know, looking at the movies, they seem a bit darker. They're not as brightly lit as you think about something like the Angry Birds movie or like Minions, something that's just, it's bathed in light the whole movie. Even in like, I think of Minions and the dungeon scene is incredibly well lit for being a dungeon underground in a castle. You know, so there's kind of this connection that I think that Laika kind of carries the torch of Jim Henson's sort of ideology of, you know, these 80s fairy tale movies that Henson really wanted to be able to tell, of, you know, going a little bit darker, going a little bit scarier. Cause I mean, even in like Kubo, there are certainly some scary moments. But you know, I think of Coraline definitely having its kind of scary imagery.
Oh, it's freaky.
And yeah, I mean, The Box Trolls is a very dark movie and kind of gross and stuff like that. Like, not gross in like a funny way, but kind of gross in like a really gross way, you know? And so like, that's not necessarily, maybe that has something to do with it. It's just been burned into our minds that we're like, we like the bright, you know, the bright colors of modern day animation that, you know, kids can tend to shy away from movies that might have a, not even just a darker tone or address some darker material, which Kubo and the Two Strings certainly addresses a little bit, I guess you could call it darker material than some other movies might. But even aesthetically, I think the movie just, they trend a bit darker and a little bit more grounded and realistic, maybe something that might make people uncomfortable at times. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I just think that they're carrying on this, that kernel of an idea that, you know, Henson would always talk about. It's okay for children to get a little scared.
Well, so then all the cards out on the table as a dad.
Yeah.
What are you doing when your kids say, oh, I want to see Kubo?
I'm saying, let's do it. You know, I think the only thing that's ever held me back from taking my kids to a movie is if I feel like taking them to the theater is going to scare them. Because, you know, like my 3.5-year-old, he doesn't like loud noises. None of my children have liked loud noises. Like they usually hate fireworks till they get to be about my oldest son's age, about 8. Mm-hmm. Then they're like, all right, cool. Loud noises are great. but you know, I mean, I even did that when I was a kid. I used to wear earplugs to the fireworks till I got a little bit older, cause they'd freak me out. And you know, my 6-year-old and my 3.5-year-old, I think Eliza, my 6.5-year-old, she would soldier through those kind of things, but I think she might get a little scared at moments. But I think a lot of it has to do with just the lights and the sounds, you know? I mean, I think that can be distracting. And taking kids to movies is like the worst thing in the world.
It is, especially if you don't have kids at the movies.
I saw Storks, and it was in a theater filled with children and parents, and I was like one of the few people there that was like a single adult male.
I'm not creepy in any way.
I'm sitting next to another member of the press, and he clearly at one point was like turning around, kind of being like, and then he like leaned forward in his chair to try and get as far away from the noise coming from behind him as possible. And I thought that was comical. Whereas for me as a parent, I'm like, wow, this is just like background noise to when I watch movies.
Yeah. I'm just used to this at this point. Yeah.
So, you know, I'm going to let my kids see things, you know, unless I really think that there might be something in the movie that I find maybe challenging for somebody like 6 years old to fully understand in like a really bad way. But, you know, I think about my kids. I've made my kids watch a lot of movies where they cry, you know, during it or after it. And I don't think that that's a bad thing, you know, like it sounds terrible. I make my children cry when I watch movies with them, mm-hmm. but I don't think that's a bad thing. You know, I think back, if we're speaking of animated films, to Inside Out, you know, Inside Out kind of taught us that it's okay to cry. Mm. It's okay to be sad. And I want my kids to cry and be sad and be able to process through those things. So, and you know, sometimes I want them to be scared, but I want them to know, you know, in the end, like I always tell them, you know, let's remember that David said in the Psalms, when I'm afraid, I put my trust in you, God, when I am afraid, you mm-hmm. know, not if I'm afraid or I won't be afraid because you're with me. It says, when I am afraid, mm-hmm. you are inevitable. With me.
Yeah.
You know? Mm-hmm. And so that's what I always tell my kids. So you know, if you're afraid, you know, what's true?
Yeah.
You know, God is with you and he's got people here to protect you.
Well, what I like about what you're saying is kind of what you're hinting at, but not making a point of, which is there's an underlying understanding that you are engaging your children.
Yes.
With what they're watching. You're not just being like, here, I heard this got good ratings on Metacritic, so sit down and watch it.
Enjoy this movie, child.
Yeah. Like you're following up, you're talking to them, you're processing their emotions, their feelings, their questions, their concerns, and I think the thing that you're not really mentioning because of the way I phrased the question is when they're, I'm guessing, super joyous that they just watched a really awesome or cool thing, you're getting to enjoy that.
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, talking deeper about it with them, because I think sometimes, especially the older ones, are starting to get old enough where they actually have legitimate questions about what's happening in the movie.
Yeah.
And that's an exciting time in a parent's life, you know, is to be able to start engaging with that stuff. And hopefully that doesn't stop with them.
Yeah. Well, so giving Griffin a shot here. I won't ask you to answer any hypotheticals. What I want to know, Griffin, is from just a purely film enjoyment perspective, is this movie as good as people are telling me it is?
Yes.
Like
yes.
Yes.
I mean, and so why? Like no what is it about? What is it about Kubo and the Two Strings? What is it about this movie that Leica Studios has created makes it one of the best movies? One of the best animated movies, at least, if not best movies of the year.
And I want to avoid, I know typically we say, okay, this is like a spoiler full review, but I imagine there might be a lot of people listening who haven't seen this movie yet. And just because of the numbers coming out of the box office, tell me that that's true.
But we're still going to spoil it. So
we're still going to spoil it some, but what I don't want to hastily, you know, tell you about is There is an element of this film and the way that the story is told that was so surprising, and it happened so early on, but it was so surprising to me that I was just like, that is one of the coolest storytelling methods I've ever seen in a film. And I think that, you know, it's just something animated films have this great ability to make you enjoy things that you never thought could be as cool as the animated film makes them. I think, you know, I think about the movie you're talking about, Storks, which I'm not sure if it actually turns out this way, but I saw the preview for it and I was like, you know, storks delivering things that could actually be like, they make me actually believe that that could be cool in seeing the preview. And so, but I think about,
no comment. You'll have to wait for my early review tomorrow.
I'll wait for the review, but yeah, I'm curious because with this film, like, I remember whenever it got to that point, I was sitting there with my fiance and I turned to her and I was just like, holy crap, that was awesome. Because it's just basically one of the characters just has, one of the characters is a storyteller, and the way that he tells stories is so interesting and so enthralling. And then it turns into being like a part of his power and a part of his abilities that you find out about in the movie. And so I think that it's things like that. It's the unique ways that this movie sought to tell us a new story. One that didn't just say, didn't just simply point out the value of family, didn't just simply point out the value of memory, didn't just simply point out the value of community. It did all those things in a unique way and in a new way. And I think it was just fun to watch. So yes, in answering your question in very short, it is as cool as it appeared to be, and as people are telling you to be that it is. And I remember I got to work the next day, and I've got this friend of mine at work, and her and her husband are way into, you know, odd films. He's big into horror, she's big into animated and that sort of thing. And I was just like, you guys, like, tomorrow night, Tuesday night, because they usually go on the cheaper Tuesday nights in town, one of the theaters. And I was like, you guys need to go see that movie. Because it's one of those things that I think if I don't convince you to go watch it, I haven't done a good service to you as a friend. So it's the same thing I'll tell you about a film like, totally different, but it's the same thing I would say. Like I said, I remember telling you, Mikey, whenever I saw Citizen 4 and Short Term 12, I was like, these kind of movies are the movies that no one will tell you to go watch, but you need to watch them. Mm. Like most people are not talking about these things, but trust me, they are as good as you've heard like one or two people say they are. And I think this one lives up to that hype for sure.
Well, I think something that's very interesting, and you were dancing around it, which makes me almost feel bad that I want to kind of,
you want to give me more time?
No, not necessarily time, but I want you to dive into this one little piece, which is, I think a pretty large part, honestly, of the story, which is Kubo, our hero, this small child who lives with his mom, who has absconded with him from her family because something bad is going to happen to him if she doesn't hide him. He goes down to the village every day and tells these stories through this magic that's not necessarily explained, but he plays, and I wrote this down, he plays a magical shamisen, which is basically a banjo type instrument, and manipulates paper through these powers and kind of brings them to life and tells these really compelling stories. The knock on him being that people say that he's pretty good at telling stories, but not so good at ending them. But for this podcast purposes, we say that story is powerful. And I think there is definitely something here in Kubo that's talking about the power that story has. And I'm interested to see, to hear what you guys think about what Kubo and the Two Strings is saying or trying to convince us of about story in particular and the power that it may or may not have.
Yeah. I'm curious, Josh and Mikey, as you guys watch this film, you know, it doesn't end at all with, I wouldn't call it a happy ending. I would call it an ending, and I would say that it isn't sad or depressing, but everything doesn't work out for the hero in the end. He's kind of left with this grandfather he doesn't know and who doesn't know the world. He's kind of left without the two parents. You know, the father he never had and the mother that he barely had. Now they're both gone. And I think that it, just like the way that he tells his stories and the way that his mother tells her stories to him, which is the ones that he's conveying to the village, I think Kubo and Two Strings is getting at this idea of like, well, you know, enjoy the story that you have today. Today you have, you know, three quarters of a story told to you, by, you know, you don't have the next step. You don't have the ending. You don't have, the last line, and you don't know that it's going to work out perfectly. But that doesn't mean you shouldn't enjoy this, you know, magical ride. And I'm not trying to say that to just like, be like, you know, just enjoy what you have and just the universe and all these. I think that to take it a step further, it's really breathing in deeply, this idea of like, don't worry about tomorrow. Don't worry about the next step in this story. And I think so often, when we're talking about films, we get hung up on whether the ending was where we liked it. I remember Inception was one that just everyone argued over the ending. And I was like, but it was a good movie. If you rip that out of it, it was like you were enthralled by that story. It didn't matter what the ending was. Like, it didn't matter whether he was there or he wasn't. It really doesn't. And I think that Kubo and the Two Strings hits at that so well and strikes a good balance there, because it gives you an ending that feels satisfying, but not satisfying in like this ultra positive way. And I'm curious if you guys felt the same way felt differently as you finished out, you know, this, what was like a really long children's movie, 2 hours and 15 minutes. That's a lengthy kids movie, which I think is maybe another thing that when we talk about kids movies, that's one thing that I would probably prefer not to be the case for a kids movie. I remember, you know, if you watch any Miyazaki films, about half of them are like 2.5 hours.
Yeah.
And they're amazing films, but for a kid, you have to watch it in parts. So it's just kind of like, oh, this is just like, we're getting late. Time to go home. You're exhausted. So I'm curious for you guys if you felt the same way about that. But I was grateful for the 2 hours and 15 minutes I got of that film. But I recognize that, yeah, these movies can get difficult when they're that long for kids, I'm sure.
You know, I think that one of the hardest things, I think the biggest hurdle I had when I got out of this movie was to get over that ending that you were talking about, that it doesn't really end on like maybe the triumphant note that we necessarily want our movies to end. Like, I think that could be true of almost anybody, much less an animated movie where we're kind of like, oh, we need it all to feel really nice and good and everything at the end.
There needs to be a new bow here.
Yeah. And I think that was the biggest hurdle. And I think the story elements of this is maybe what tripped up a lot of people. You know, there I've heard everything from, well, you know, it was the ending was kind of, you know, the last third of the movie was kind of blah. And or, you know, they don't know how to write, you know, at Laika at all. They don't know how to write, you know, a good full length story. And other people were saying, you know, it's just it's a pretty standard, you know, adventure story, or, you know, hero's journey or something like that, you know, essentially kind of downplaying the story elements of the movie. But I think the biggest thing that you learn in the, it's a story about storytelling, you know, it's like story and there's stories within a story. And, you know, there's that magical
multiple
sequence.
Multiple stories within a stories, right?
Right. Exactly. Exactly. And I think that, you know, you think about like, just when Kubo goes to the village and tells the story using the dancing, you know, the origami that's sort of magical, like you said, that's not really explained to us at all. It's this magical moment where you realize you're sitting down and listening to a story of a story, and you're caught up in this entire thing. And I think that it kind of boils it down to the fact that like we as a culture, stories have power, not only because like we've been I believe that we've been programmed to love story, and it's just a part of the DNA of human beings is to tell stories and to be a part of a story. But what I see in this movie is kind of like a building up of storytelling, and how I see the ending, you know, even though it's not maybe what we're expecting it to be, it's this, I feel like it's true to what the whole movie was about, which was about, you know, how your story is told can ultimately affect who you are. And you kind of have Kubo at the beginning having this one story about himself that actually turns out to be a true story. And then at the end you have, do we have to do this every time and be like, hey, we're totally spoiling the ending of this movie, or you should pretty much know this by now? Oh, we did? Oh, okay, great. But you know, just his grandfather, you know, the Moon King, how his story is being retold. And at first I was kind of like, oh, this is kind of a dumb ending and I don't really get this at all. But I came to understand and really appreciate this ending a lot more as kind of being this, the village sort of coming around, and that there is a better story that can inform our story. So like the grandfather is this, you know, sinister Moon King who wants to essentially kill Kubo. And he retells a story, you know, instead of exacting revenge or completing his journey by defeating evil or defeating the bad guy, he actually redeems his father by telling a better story to his grandfather. And I found that after some reflection, incredibly profound, you know, that our stories can be redeemed, and that there can be a better story for us, even if we've, you know, written a story for ourselves that is not necessarily what we may have wanted, or, you know, maybe a bad story. So I thought it was incredibly significant that ending, it really stuck with me after a while, where at first in the theater, I was kind of like, oh yeah, well, this ending wasn't very good, but, I eventually came around on it very, very much and liked it a lot more than I thought I would.
So I'm a little bit torn because I still think, after much reflection, that I did not like the ending. And I'll tell you why, because I know you're curious. But I think it's what you've already mentioned. On the one hand, I love, and many, especially Christian reviewers, have kind of pointed this out, that it's almost this really beautiful picture of an evil, kind of like unloving, distanced from humanity, non-understanding or seeing like our humanity as weakness, come down and, you know, through the events of the kind of climax, loses all of his memory. And instead of being like, ha, you're human, let's stab you, you know, mm-hmm. for all the evil, for, you know, destroying our village, for trying to kill people, for, you know, not seeing, you know, it, what, never having value for people. Instead of doing what you would see most people do to the villain, which is, you know, foot on their chest, planting their flag, a victory over villain, you actually see an entire village tell this now human grandfather, former Moon King, these stories about what he used to be like, and assuming that it would change who he is. And I love the fact, like I said, on the one hand, that they don't just stab him or whatever you would do in a movie like this. On the other hand, I love the fact that, or I also love the fact that they're using story to redeem, which I think is what the grand narrative of the Bible is basically doing. It's telling this story. It's all about our redemption. Mm-hmm. So I love like the parallel there, but the biggest difference and the thing that rubs me the wrong way is when we think about story and its power to not only compel us, I mean, change us, and the redemption that's found in the story of Christianity. This story with the Moon King was based on lies and deception, and I had this very interesting conversation with a friend because I was very vexed at the end of this film, like in this thing that I'm trying to explain to you guys, where on one hand I love to see something different, on the other hand I wish it wasn't built on deception, because, you know, are we our actions? Is there something deeper inside us that compels us to do things outside of who we are? I mean, on one hand, we act out of our identity in Christ. We have a history of, like, especially like the Jewish people, handing down stories from generation to generation, reminding people of who they are, where they've come from, and where they're going, who their God is, how he's powerful, even when it doesn't seem like it. But on the other hand, we're assuming that no matter what we tell ourselves, there's not something in us that's going to continue to act the way it was. So in this particular case, the Moon King is being told these falsehoods. And in a perfect world, I would love to believe that he's going to act out of these things and say, oh, you were the most generous person in the village. Oh, you always did give the kids like little pieces of candy. Oh, you were the greatest. You helped do all these things. But even if someone lost their memory, isn't there a piece of us that through action, through repetition, there's something that kind of imprints on us deeper that says, this is who I kind of am. And I mean, do we take that all the way to salvation? And like, I don't even necessarily know where I want to go with this, but it brings up so many questions, which is why I'm kind of curious. Is any of this resonating with you guys? Like, did you not have any of these questions? Are you not concerned that maybe we're less than our actions or more than our actions? You know, what does the Bible say? What is it to be something with a spirit? We're more than repetition. Like, so I throw that out there.
Yeah. Josh, if you have something, yeah, please go ahead.
Okay. I mean, I guess I, first of all, I'm going to say on the idea of sort of our actions, kind of putting an imprint on us, if you want to say it that way, you know, I could almost think of that in the fact we don't really get to see the effects of how this different story, which I think, Mikey, you're nailing down what I was having a problem with, is that it was definitely like the first inclination I had is, but all of these things aren't true. Mm-hmm. You know, there's no truth to who he is being in this, or who they're saying he is. And sort of like, you know, you would think that I think the movie's assuming that he has some sort of amnesia, you know, almost like he has no idea who he is. And mm-hmm. it's their job to sort of cultivate a different story for him in that effect. And so I think maybe that was some of the bridge that got me over that. But, you know, as far as this action, I think it does. And we don't get to see the results of that. Maybe if who he had been before butts up against this newer story. And I think we can see that a lot. You know, I think about how, you know, to speak at it from a biblical perspective, it's the journey, like when we put our faith and trust in Christ, that doesn't mean that we are instantly 100% holy on this earth, I should say. In the eyes of God, yes, you know, we are covered by Christ, and we are seen as righteous because of Christ's death on the cross and his resurrection. But on this earth, our actions still have had repercussions. The stone has already been dropped in the water, and the ripples are going out from there. So you think of somebody who may have murdered someone, there are still effects to other people. There is still effect on your psyche. There are still things that you will probably be working on for the rest of your life, you know, to overcome maybe some of the baggage that came with, you know, that particular action. And I think that there are extreme consequences to the actions that we have. And we may reap some of the benefits, or we may have to reap that here on earth. I don't know how that could play. I don't think the Bible is somewhat specific in addressing, does that, you know, continue with us into eternity or not? But I don't think that we necessarily can give a definitive answer like, yes, you know, your offense shall have consequences here and now, you know, now and later. But, you know, I think, Griffin, do you have something to add to this part of it? Because I kind of wanted to go in a little bit of a different direction to address this, like,
yeah,
on a bigger scale, but I'd like you to be able to have a chance to address this part as well.
Yeah. I think movie wise, I really love the picture that it paints of this idea of this man is told of his identity that is not true about him in that moment. You know, they just saw the worst parts of him. They just watched him attack and kill two people. I mean, they just saw the worst parts of him, and they were like, you know, but your identity is not this. Even though they don't know that to be true, I would say scripturally, it seems clear to me that scripture says the same thing about us, is like, when Christ comes to us, he doesn't have a reason to believe that it is true of us that we are righteous, that we are robed in any sort of righteousness, and that we have that on our own. And we don't. The fact is that we don't. But I think that at the same time, he speaks to us and says, you are, because I am, because I created that for you. I went there and I did that, and I paid that debt for you so that you would be righteous in the sight of my Father. And so I think that when I saw the end of that, yeah, I felt very much like similarly about that as I did about my own life. And I was just like, oh, he is getting told of his new identity. In his place of needing to be reminded and needing to be shown that he is better than the sum of his parts and the sum of what he's been up to this point, this community is actually saying to him, your identity is not what we just witnessed. That idea is not fully fleshed out, partly because another thing that's not fully fleshed out that I want to see it one more time, because I want to be like, all right, is this even feasible? I'm actually kind of curious if you're left to kind of wonder one way or another whether this entire story was just a fiction, or if the fantasy of the entire story was actually Kubo's story, like it was actually another story that he was telling. And so I'm really, because I felt like the grandfather was not amnesiac, but like you were meant to think that he was having like Alzheimer's or something like that. So I'm curious. I really want to see it again to get another look at it, because I was like, I wonder if maybe this was just like all a part of another fiction story that Kubo was telling. But not to get into too much of that here, because like I said, I don't have it thought out enough to really have much more than that, but yeah, I honestly really did like the ending, and it wasn't, like I said, it wasn't as satisfying as, say, him having both of his parents at the end, and him, you know, having just this great community. But he did he was left with a community that did like him and did love him and did enjoy him. And he had that grandmother figure who, I mean, in the realm of supporting characters in a animated film, is she the funniest and most fun character? I really enjoyed her a lot. And so I'm curious if you, yeah, but yeah, all that being said, I enjoyed reading.
Well, okay. So let me say this, to maybe semi wrap that thought up. And that is basically the experience that it sounds like you had, Griffin, was the experience that I started to have until I thought about it. Mm. And the more I thought about it, like I said, the more I wanted it to be clean. I wanted it to be a one for one. I wanted there to be that, hey, this is a picture of the gospel, you know? Mm. This is a picture of redemption. This is a picture of someone coming down and saying, you are not what you think. Like, the world is bigger and there is this truth that you don't understand. And, you know, God is this, Christ is this, because of that, you are this. That's beautiful. The problem is it just doesn't work, because if you try to make that the metaphor or the analogy, it doesn't work, because all the stuff that he's being told are lies. Whereas when we're told that, it's truth. It's just reminding us of something we never knew. Mm-hmm. And it's very confusing to what the filmmakers think about that, because in the film we see two very opposing views of what it looks like to lose your memory, because we see Beetle, who's lost his memory, but with no memory, he still acts out of this kind of like idea or these like actions that have defined him for a long time. So he's still, even though no one's there to tell him a story, he has more or less followed the same kind of heart path that he had before, just not recognizing that he was kind of the hero of the story for a while. And on the other side, like I said, we get to the Moon King, who is given a different story. But we're expecting him to actually not follow the path that he was on before. Mm. When it seems like the rules of the movie say that that's not how it's going to work.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's ambiguous, and I'm curious. Like, I don't know if they thought that they cared that we were going to think this hard about the movie. So,
Well, and yeah, I don't know. So you're obviously coming down more on the side of like the ending, or that portion of the ending, it kind of fell flat for you.
Well, yeah, but that's the kind of that's the thing. Like, all the pieces were there, and so the beauty of this conversation is we can talk about really great things because of how this movie went. But when I'm doing like a one for one, or you know, I'm a pastor and I need a sermon example, this doesn't work. It's not a one for one. I can't say, hey son, you see how this happened? That's just like what it's like when, you know, God, I can't do that, 'cause it's not right. I like the, like I said, I like the fact that they talk about the power of story. I like the fact that Elijah Davidson points out in his review over at Real Spirituality that this idea that story, I mean, it's powerful and has the power to redeem, shows that instead of, you know, killing him at the end, like we talked about before, or just defeating him, whatever that looks like in an anime movie, they actually they use story to redeem him and give their enemy a better story or a new story to define their lives. So then they're not enemies anymore. And that's this really beautiful picture of reconciliation. But again, based on lies. So as long as it's based on falsehoods, like all these things that I love about the ending, don't like they just, ah, it's so good, but it just kind of falls off center just a little bit for me.
Yeah, yeah, and maybe I think that's maybe what prevents this movie for me from being like an all timer, mm-hmm. like, you know, 5 out of 5 stars. You know, I gave it 4 out of 5. But I think that's maybe what prevents it, because there's kind of this, you know, I mean, fundamentally, and I don't mean this as a knock on the movie, but this is fundamentally like a Western creative team telling an Eastern story, you know, those dichotomies. Yeah. And so, you know, there's all these things in here that it's like, I think that it brings up great conversation. Like, I love it when a movie has like a contrarian view of how maybe I would want the movie to end, because I think that allows me to think. And like you said, it's not a one for one. I can't tell my kids, like, this is a great example of the gospel, because I can't tell my kids that, you know? Because there's even like in the, and I think I mentioned this in my review, there's this whole thematic and like aesthetic choice of like light and darkness and warmth and light. Whereas like there's kind of like the warmth or light of humanity versus the darkness and, you know, coldness of deity. You know, there's this, there seems to really be, and I know a lot of people brought up like kind of the Kurosawa connection. And, you know, Kurosawa famously in like his, one of his biggest epics, Ran, he has this kind of explicit ending where, you know, it basically says all this terrible stuff happens to us. And it's either because the gods hate us or because the gods are silent. You know, there's, and I think that that kind of Eastern ideology a little bit, this Kurosawa-like idea of deity carries over this movie, where it's really like the warmth of humanity that overcomes this cold deity of the Moon King, you know, and all these other deities in this movie. So I thought that was a really interesting aspect that was kind of like, yeah, that's kind of contrary to what we would actually believe about Christ, where like his light and his warmth comes down into our darkness and brings light. So, you know, I thought that was interesting. And I think that's what kind of keeps this movie from me from resonating in a way that just like, you know, like all the heartstrings are going, you know, so all of my two strings, my two heartstrings are being plucked.
Well, so there's this really cool thing that happens then, because where this film both succeeds and fails by being a very anti-Western in its kind of its thinking or its cultural ideology, because obviously it's going to have a very Eastern mythic feel to it, which
for sure.
which does, you know, does really not leave a whole lot of room for, you know, the light coming down into the world or a guy that's very personal.
Yeah, but it does speak to every Final Fantasy player ever.
It does.
It totally is. This is an RPG game. Like, he gets other characters that have special powers that join up on his journey. So, you know, and the boss has a final form.
It does. Yeah. There's the boss evolves. Yeah, there's like mini bosses.
Yeah, exactly.
And you have to know how to defeat them.
I think I actually turned to Aaron and I was like, boss battle one, whenever they were not the boat. Yeah. It was whenever like the mom was fighting. I was like, this is boss battle one. This is like whenever Gandalf is, you know, fighting off the chasm. I wanted to call it a chasm fiend, 'cause I'm reading Brandon Sanderson right now. And God, if you like sci-fi or fantasy, should you read Brandon Sanderson? He's amazing. But Balrog. I was just thinking about the Balrog, and I was just like, oh, yes, like this is very, hero story, sure. I think there's so much about this that I love the way that it paints, because I think if I hear all those things about deity and I view them as the same way that like scripture, especially when we talk about the Old Testament, spoke about little g gods, like the, you know, nature gods that were existent, it felt very similar to the same thing that scripture talks about with them. That like, where are your gods? Like, what, you know, they're these little like stone idols. They're these little wooden idols that you've made, and are gods alive? And I think it points, you know, I think that this movie would probably say more like, we are closer to gods than gods are God. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. That it's more of a humanistic mindset than say Christianity is. But I think that it does paint those gods in a similar light that I would, to say, you've made these little idols that are out of wood and clay and stone, and they're so far from us. They're not life at all. They have no life in them. I remember I tried to write down a couple of quotes, but I, you know, it's hard when you're in a theater.
It's dark.
It's dark.
And you're busy talking to your fiance the entire time. And people are like,
shh. Nope. I only did it like once, but
I was giving Gene ammunition later.
But yeah, I remember, let me see if I can find if there's, yeah, I can't find it. Where I like had texted them to myself, but now I can't find any of them. I just see the ones about Snowden, which is another movie you should all go see. But yeah, I just remember there was a whole section where she was, he asked mom, he's like, mom, why does grandfather hate me? He doesn't hate you. He just hates these things about you. You're different than him in that you have life and you're not dark and sad like he is and distant from humanity. And I think that is just true of the way that scripture would paint these other gods is that they're distant from humanity. These things we prop up as idols, they're not true. They're not realistic at all in any way. I did give it like a 9 out of 10 or a 4.5 star. Everything about this movie, except for like the confusing nature of the ending, which is the same reason why I gave it, it didn't go all the way with that and say, yeah, was for me, just such a good film. And I think it just painted, some really cool relationships, for us as we think about what it's like to care for our family who might be different or ailing or, struggling in different ways. I think about his mother and the relationship that he had to her. And I was just like, this is one of the most beautiful pictures of friendship and like how we should love and care for our family, that I've ever seen in a film like this, because he wanted to really be there for her. And listen to her whenever he never got an ending because she didn't know that she couldn't remember the endings. I was just like, that's really beautiful. That's a really cool picture of just family and community there.
Well, I love how it paints those pictures too, because in even though the film in general runs longer than we would normally see animated films run, there are lots of really great scenes of love and compassion and human interaction that we can immediately get behind as human beings. And one of the things that kind of goes back to the, what you get from kind of trying to tell an Eastern ideology or kind of mystic spiritual story is that in the film, there seems to be a very, very great divide between like love and empathy and compassion and caring about your fellow man. And like I said, the idea even of falling in love, not just love, but falling in love and thinking of others before yourself is standing in contrast to basically eternity or like eternal life. And you can either choose to live forever, and if you do so, you do it at the forsaking of emotion and, you know, being in the nitty gritty. And I think that's a great conversation starter with a lot of people, especially if they kind of have one of those Eastern religion or Eastern philosophies, because we would say that it's actually both. Which is something that I think you were kind of getting at, Griffin, which we don't have to make that choice. It's not eternity or emotion. We are finite beings here. And we learn about love. We learn about compassion. We learn about being other centric, but that's just part of us. There's also another part that does exist forever. And that was really striking when we had to make that choice in the movie. And it also kind of took me aback, when they wanted me to really, really feel like I was in the moment. Like that was all there was. Because I'm like, well, we're not though. Like we go on forever. what that did was start to tie into these memories of people calling ghosts back. Like, oh, yeah, well, there is there is kind of a place where they go on forever, but not really.
It looks different. Yeah. And I think, I mean, because I would imagine that the storytellers are saying that these memories that go on forever, they have some activity.
Yeah.
You know, they're able to bond with him and defend him in his final moments of, you know, of yes or no, win or loss, kind of there at the end. And I feel like it's pretty clear that there's some, you know, infiniteness to those memories and to those stories.
But they're kind of referring to him as spirits though too, right?
Yeah, exactly. They're kind of referring to them as spirits. And I think that that's where, like, as with any movie, especially when we talk about, when we start to talk about movies that represent some sort of Eastern ideals, I love this about Miyazaki films. They do such a wonderful job of painting similar themes to what we would say about, you know, the Bible. And then I also have to remind myself, oh, but he also doesn't probably believe in Jesus. So he's writing from a perspective of, you know, whatever he has been brought up in, which I'm just from listening to him speak. I don't know if it's much. I don't know if Miyazaki ever really experienced much of that stuff as a kid. But so I think with this film, it's the same way. It seems like, you know, these guys were writing from an Eastern perspective to say, well, it's more memories and spirit based than it is, you know, infinite, eternal life based. And it is difficult to look at those films and say, well, for me, regardless of whether it matches up my ideals, I still love it and think that it should be everybody's, you know, everybody should watch it. Mm. Cause there are a lot of films like that, that regardless of how they match up with my ideals of what films should be or the stories it should tell, I'm like, but it's amazing. But it's incredible to watch, and it's a beautiful and fun film. And I think that there's a lot of room, and there should be a lot of room for a discussion like that to say, well, despite how much I agree with it, how much I adhere to its same beliefs and thoughts and principles, is it still one of my favorite films? I think it can be. But I wonder for you guys and for the rest of the people in the, you know, in the community here listening and a part of our staff here writing and stuff, if they feel the same way, if that feels possible and feasible.
Yeah. I think there's a strong connection in the film that there's definitely like a finality of death in the movie, but I don't think it's in the sense of like how maybe, and I think this is one of the strengths, what you were just talking about with like Miyazaki or, you know, I think this movie where it really probably one of the most significant things is that death is not, there's a finality of death, but it doesn't mean that death is the end. And I think that that stands into stark contrast of like probably a lot of the undercurrent of humanism, especially in Western culture, is like death is it, you know, we're dirt and worms after that. But there's a real sense in this movie that like there is a significance beyond death. Just what that is might not match up with what we might believe about it. Mm-hmm. But I think that it's significant that it's putting a spiritual emphasis on memories and a spiritual emphasis on our loved ones and our memories of them, instead of just kind of, there's a lot of contrasting things going on in this movie. And I think that if I maybe knew, you know, Eastern storytelling and Eastern spirituality a little bit better, I might be able to speak to it a little bit more. But I definitely see this dichotomy existing within the movie of the spiritual and the the humanity, like humanness, mm-hmm. versus the spirituality. So but it kind of ebbs and flows, and I guess I appreciate that, whereas I know other people might be like, well, it's there's too many disparate things going on here for it to make any sense to me.
Well, I like that you're pointing that anti-Western kind of thing out, because so far the anti-Westernness we've kind of talked about has been this film not matching up with something we'd say is true. But mm-hmm. actually, I think there's a lot of benefits from it kind of having like an anti-Western mindset, and it does it does deal with those memories, especially because I mentioned a while back that it is actually very anti-Western to get your identity from anything besides what you kind of choose about yourself. Like, like it's very, very Western to say, I am who I think I am, or I am who I want to be, or I can be whatever I want to be, or this doesn't define me, or where I grew up doesn't define me, or my parents don't define me. You know, I can be this, or I am that because I believe it, or, you know, et cetera. I don't want to start to make it sound like I'm making fun of these people, but that is definitely a prevalent mindset in Western culture. Like, you are who you think you are, basically. And mm-hmm. it's very anti-Western, on the other hand, to say, much like we see in the Bible, like, people being reminded of who they are based on where they came from, based on things that they had nothing to do with. And actually, I've been listening to the Screwtape Letters recently, and there's this really great passage that talks about how Screwtape is kind of just almost laughing at humanity because, like, the things we take credit for, like our skills and gifts and talents. And he's like, it doesn't make any more sense for us to, or for, you know, the animals to brag about the skills they have than it does the color of their hair, or, you know, who their parents were, cause they had no control of it. It's all gifts from, you know, the enemy, which, you know, in our case would be the creator. And, this movie kind of points back to, I think, like I said, something that I think the Jewish people still actually look to. And that's the idea that, like, their history is a gift. Their memories are a gift. Like, the who they are, where they've come from, all this is a gift. And it can get us out of a lot of things. We actually see in this film memories come to life, you know, in the form of Monkey and Beetle, and help someone in the present get through hardships. If that's not a visual representation for what really remembering where we come from is, then I mean, I don't know what else they're trying to do there, because it stops being a metaphor. They literally make the memories come to life and help them, which is something that I don't think that we do. You know, our church is going through this thing, or, culture, or I was in an argument with an atheist, or there was this agnostic who brought up this great point, and I think they're probably pretty much the first person in history who's ever brought up this point theologically, which is obviously not true. You know, like, we've dealt, as Christians, we have such a rich history of stories and memories and working through problems. Like, what does it look like to, when politics and theology mix up too much, what does that look like? We don't have any examples of that.
Let us not forget that this is like, this has happened time and time again over much greater issues than even. And I think we look at the current scene and we say, These distinctions between believer and believer on one side of the aisle or another are too great, and they've just never been overcome like this before. And then I'm like, they have time and time again. And I think to view the church as this thing that hasn't held up in spite of all these differences over the years, that hasn't been able to weather the storm, and to view it as this thing, well, if it's not changing as quickly as culture is changing, then we've got a problem. No, if it's not changing as quickly as culture is changing, that's a good thing. Mm-hmm. Because if it was to change as quickly as culture is changing, we would be looking at a church that is not at all the Bride of Christ. You know, we would look at a very quickly, quickly changed and quickly affected mm-hmm. bride. And that's not what scripture calls us to be at all. I would imagine that God would look down at that and say, what's going on here?
Well, that's the beauty of it, because when we look around, we look to our left, we look to our right, we see, you know, words like relevant and, you know, cutting edge or extreme. We see all these people that are fighting in their churches or their particular slices of theology to have updated Christianity to a certain point that it has finally attained some goal or achieved some goal. almost at the detriment of the history of the church. And actually, it's been one of the most encouraging things over the past year and a half as I've started to read more and more about church history to see how the church has failed over and over and over again. I want to describe the history of the church as like peaks and valleys, but it's more like valleys and valleys and like a couple plateaus. But it's been amazing to look throughout the course of like just human history and then Christianity in general and see how God has worked through all these things, through the worst things that humanity has done. See his hand at lifting up and holding off. Like those memories are invaluable to me. And as an encouragement, I feel like I can't replace them. And I actually feel bad for people who are trying to throw out tradition or throw out church history because they've got a better way. I'm not saying that they don't have some good ideas, but just throwing it out, oh man, it's rough.
Yeah, I mean, I agree that it, just to toss out these things so quickly is not, you know, it just doesn't line up. It doesn't fit in. And I think we would, yeah, as I said earlier, I think to look at the church as something that should sway as quickly as everything else is. Hmm. You've got a serious problem and you're going to the wrong place. Go to fashion industry. Maybe that would move quicker for you.
Dang.
Because I just don't think, that it's necessary or better yet appropriate. Because tomorrow it's, you know, we're going to be more concerned with something else. And I think that's been shown time and time again as a culture, that tomorrow it's, well, we don't care about that. We forgot about that. That's out of the news cycle. We're talking about something else. And that's not to say that the things that are important today are not important a year from now or tomorrow. They are. Just realize that the rest of the church is the people in leadership, the people attempting to push those things forward. They aren't, I don't think they're as stupid to what's happening and what needs to happen as you think they are. And as we often think they are.
It's been a tough word brought to you by Griffin Kale.
I'm just speaking. Yeah. I mean, Mikey, you and I mean, we sat in your living room last Wednesday and had this exact conversation. I'm not going to act like we don't live in the same neighborhood and we don't hang all the time. You know, we sat in your living room and had this exact conversation because we were so frustrated, and this kind of gets totally off topic of Kubo and the Two Strings, but I think it's just, yeah, in this season, if you're listening still right now, I hope you are, just realize that, yeah, there, the church is a very, very, very capable, entity to weather, some of these things, and is also, you know, whether it takes a long time or not, which I don't disagree that it took the church way too long to make a lot of decisions in the past. Like will eventually land itself firmly on the side of what scripture would say is right and best. So yeah, you can edit that out later if you desire and I won't be offended. It just bothers me because I realize that, yeah, there are a lot of people out there, myself included, that are, yeah, we're just, oh man, the church needs to get on board with what's going on here. And it's like, yeah, but it's a huge ship. Try turning that thing. Because everyone has different opinions and you can't just leave them all behind because you disagree with them. You can't just say, well, those sheep just don't deserve to be a part of the flock anymore because I disagree with them. That's not the Bible at all. And I think that needs to be realized at times. Yeah.
That's good.
Yeah. Which is why I think kind of, Mikey, steering back towards what you were saying before.
Yeah.
About the ending. I think we're going to keep coming back to this ending. We're making these circles around this ending, this whole podcast. you know, that I kind of think that almost this idea of like a community of people speaking a better story is kind of a good picture of what the church should be to people.
I completely agree. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's this great dichotomy, you know, that exists within, like, where in our culture, speaking, you know, other people speaking into our reality is not something that we normally want. We want to be self-actualized, not community actualized. And I think that that's a great picture. And maybe that's what I'm taking away more, which is why I like the ending as mm-hmm. compared to others who have kind of been tepid on the ending of the movie. So, I think that's really cool.
Well, as I guess start to wrap us up a little bit.
Yes.
I want to say this. I wish I liked this movie more. And I think it's because the people who saw it before me told me it was so incredibly good. I did have unrealistic expectations. We haven't even gotten into like to any serious degree how beautiful the movie is. yeah. And I know we can talk about we could talk about that for some time, and I want to emphasize that it is very, very visually stimulating, engaging, just fun to watch. But the thing about it is when I thought about like kids watching it or something like that, I was like, this movie is actually a little bit slow. It's actually a lot bit slow. I was actually kind of not super into it, except for the animation, probably for about the first half hour. And then it picks up a little bit once the sisters, who with kind of one of my final thoughts, the sisters were amazing. They were done amazing. Rooney Mara was great. The cast in general was very, very cool. It's kind of odd to hear Matthew McConaughey as a Japanese Beetle kind of thing, but,
all right.
It was really crazy, right? So, yeah. but in general, it was a little slow, but picked up and was so cool at points. It made up for it at others. That was kind of like my real takeaway, and I would encourage people to see it, but I did want to like it more. But I'm really glad that you guys both really, really enjoyed it, because I think this is one of those few films where I enjoyed it less than I enjoyed the conversation I wanted to have about it. Mm-hmm. As soon as the film was over, I was like, well, we have plenty to talk about. There are lots of different ways we could go. So, trying to keep us in the wrap up mode. Josh, do you have any final thoughts? Anything we just completely missed or you really wanted to mention? Like I said, that you maybe really liked or maybe still didn't like that you didn't mention, or just something we just completely, we dropped the ball on.
Yeah. You know, I think I'm just going to double up, cause I was going to, if you didn't get to it, just interject and talk about sort of the artistic visuals in this movie and just how I think a lot of the merits of this movie rest on just how wonderful it is and how beautiful it is and how much creative energy went into this movie. Mm-hmm. I think about the fact that I read in an article that each of the animators was basically given like 2 to 3 minutes of the movie, and they did, that's all they did for 18 months was animate 2 to 3 minutes of this movie. And that's incredible. You know, with the amount of movies that come out now that it seems like there's just a lot of pointing and clicking and dragging of CGI. You know, I think one of the things that we don't have time to get into is how even if something is not realistic, does that immediately merit it being less of a movie if it's not realistic? Like, say, for example, like stop motion animation, mm-hmm. Or like, you know, I think back to like Ray Harryhausen's stop motion animation. Does the Kraken of the 1981 Clash of the Titans, is it immediately a bad movie or a worse movie than the most recent Clash of the Titans, which uses the computer animated, you know, Kraken? Is that better? And I just think that this movie is a big backhand to anybody who's going to think that. Even though this movie is incredibly well executed, and obviously it's an animated movie, there is so much lazy computer generated animation nowadays where like this is just a breath of fresh wind that, you know, I don't think that stop motion animation's on the way out. You know, it's kind of always been a boutique sort of animation style in the first place. But I think that Leica's got this incredible thing going on that I think could lead to some really great kind of hybrid use of that technology that could actually create better animated art than we have been able to get with even the best of CGI. So it's another thing to merit this movie on, like, go see this movie because it's got technical merits that are not going to be matched by many movies. It needs to be seen for just how incredibly well done and how much attention to detail this movie has in it.
I can't really argue with that. Like I said, even as someone who didn't, like I said, love the movie, I feel like people still need to see it because I still think there's a good chance other people will love it because there's enough there. And it's, like I said, it's like watching someone's labor of love, you know?
So. Yeah, for sure. And clearly the Moon King's armor has a Death Star on it. So
it's true. It's true.
Yeah, I echo all of Josh's and your sentiments, Mikey, about just the beauty of this film. I think it's worth seeing just for that. And I said that earlier that I would definitely, you know, watch this again, even if they told me, oh, the speakers aren't working and we'll let you watch it for free. Sure. In a heartbeat.
Yeah, no sound, just visually.
Yeah, because it's just incredible. It is a really, really, really pretty film. And I continue to be so excited because I think every time one of these stop motion or claymation or these animated films like this come out, that's the conversation that's had about them. Every time a Miyazaki film comes out, people still rave over, wow, that art is just beautiful. And I'm like, you know why? Because it was still done by hand. It was still done by a single guy sitting at a table and creating something, or gal. And I think I'm glad that there's still some value in that, publicly, and worldwide. Cause yeah, it just gives me a little bit of hope for where animated films are going long-term. But yeah, besides that, I think, final thoughts, just despite what we have talked about and the differences in opinion we've had about this film tonight, I think it's worth going to see because I think it will start some cool conversations. I think it will start some conversations about, family and story and, everywhere in between for you guys, as you're beginning to actually talk about what happened, what did you just see and why? Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I think as with any movie that we talk about on here, these conversations aren't going to happen if you just like leave the movie and you're like, do you like it? Cool. Let's go. But I think if you step into it beyond that, this movie has a lot of really wonderful things going on.
Nice. Well, as we end this, we remind everyone that this conversation doesn't have to stop here. It can continue in our Facebook discussion group, at the website, or with our guests. And if you'd like to continue this conversation with our guests, you'd like to tell them what you thought of the film, how they like it too much, or they the ending wasn't as good as they thought it was, or
I like it too much. That's okay.
or like I said, or they maybe mentioned something that you want to hear them talk more about. Please, like I say, come to our Facebook discussion group, the Real World Theology on Facebook, or contact them. So Josh, how can people contact you or follow what you do around the web?
Hey, well, you can find me on Twitter at Hey, It's That Josh. I've been using Twitter a lot more than I ever have before, which I'm very proud of myself for doing. Of course you can, all three of us are on the Facebook discussion group, but you can find us there. If you post questions, we'll respond. Sometimes maybe we'll like it. Maybe we'll put in a funny meme to respond to what you have to say. But we will definitely try to engage with you in conversation. We've always got some great conversations going on there. And of course, it would not be a podcast if I did not plug the Facebook for Movie Lovers Letterboxd. That's right, Letterboxd. It's a place where you can go and you can keep a diary of movies and you can talk about them. Hey, you can even comment on there to say something about like, hey, I totally disagree with your opinion. Or, hey, I love your opinion. Where can I read more about what you have to say about movies? And so Letterboxd is great. You need to be on there. I'm so glad when I hear that people join Letterboxd because of the efforts of Real World Theology.
That's what we're really here for.
It really is.
Preaching that Letterboxd gospel, baby.
That's right. Real World Letterboxd.
And it has an app now, so unless you're playing crimes and you have every excuse in the world not to use it.
They weren't 12 years late to that fad of an app.
Yeah, I know.
Jeez Louise. Whenever that thing finally came out, I was like, Mikey was like, they got an app now. I was like, Mikey, it's been 3 years since you told me about Letterboxd. That's okay, though. I'm trying. But yeah, as well, Facebook, Griffin Kale. First name spelled not like they would in a fantasy novel. And last name spelled like the wonderful vegetable. It's late. It's like 10:30. Time to go to bed. that you all know and love. And you can find me on Facebook. And that's really about it at the moment. The website is still up, griffinkale.com. But maybe not for much longer. I'm trying to make a budget decision about how much I put into that thing long term. But that being said, you can also, if you desire, I'm going to just, maybe this is a first, I'm not sure, here on the Rural Theology, but griffinakale@gmail.com. I'd love to chat with you more, as long as you don't, you know, send me threatening comments about my opinions, because truly, it's just opinions about movies. It's not that big a deal. It's really not.
It's a big deal.
How dare you, sir?
Wow.
It's not something to get angry over. But it's not something to like slay someone over. I didn't like Batman versus Superman either. And you know what? That's okay. The Lord still loves me, and I'm still a son in his sight.
Griffin with the real controversial opinion that Batman v Superman is not a good movie.
Super controversial. Exception. What?
Well, send all your emails and hate mail to griffinakale@gmail.com.
I'll accept it.
I see that email. I see that email. I see that email.
And I drag it to the trash can.
Well, if you are so inclined, you may follow me at Fizzification on Twitter. Most of the ways you're going to get me is to come join our Facebook discussion group, where I troll as much as possible. And so give people great stuff. So what you can do to help this podcast, because I know you were thinking, what can I do to help this podcast? Go to iTunes, rate, and review our show. We would love more of you, because we know there are, we talk to all kinds of people all the time. Rare a day goes by when I don't have a conversation with someone who I did not listen to the show, or listen to it, or just found it. Please go to iTunes and rate and review the show. The more ratings, the more reviews we get, the more it kind of bumps our rankings and people can kind of find us a little bit easier and they can join the conversation. And that's kind of what we're here to do. Start these conversations, really think about how these films are affecting culture or kind of putting these vibes out in culture. You know, like I said, sometimes they look really, really close to what we believe in the gospel, kind of like the ending there of Kubo, but it's just as off, just a touch. And we want to be there to kind of have these conversations with our kids, with our friends, with our family. So hopefully that we started that conversation. Feel free to carry it on.
Just remember, every time you do a 5-star review, we will send a Blu-ray copy of Batman v Superman to Griffin.
which is what it's all about. So yeah. He's running out of space too. You know, he's gonna get a new apartment. We want floor to ceiling BVS.
Yeah, I need something to set my toilet paper on.
Boy,
jeez Louise, that's shot
gone south fast.
Well, you made me do this. Okay,
You
made me do this. Yeah.
That's very thematically appropriate. Never mind. Derailed. Okay. Stop. So thank you guys for taking the time to be here, even though it's late where Griffin and I are. We don't have good conversations without good guests. So thanks. And make sure you guys follow them on social media. Make sure you follow their work around the web. They're Josh and Griffin are smart guys. And when they write something, it's probably at least worth a couple minutes of your time. So, thanks for doing that. Thanks for listening to the show. You know, You, listeners, are the reason we do this. You've given us great feedback. We've had amazing conversations with you. So thanks for listening. Thanks for making us a part of your week, your month, your drive to work, whatever. And I guess until next episode, remember that story is powerful and entertainment is not mindless. Bye-bye.
Bye.
This podcast has been a Real World Theology production. For more information, check out realworldtheology.com. And thanks for listening.
Now this is podcasting. Woo!
Yeah, and I was like, well, that does kind of sound like some of the guests we'd have.
Tonight's episode is brought to you by Kirkland Signature Sparkling Water. 0 calories in 3 delicious flavors.